I'm Joanne Wilson, and this is Positively Gotham Gal. Small, meaningful conversations with women entrepreneurs about their approach to life, business, and everything in between. Kelsey Recht is the founder and CEO of VenueBook, an event management platform that allows event planners and venue managers to work together in a digitalized, collaborative environment. Prior to VenueBook, Kelsey worked in finance and corporate strategy at Fidelity Investments and Sears Holding. So, very happy to have you here today, Kelsey.
Thank you for having me.
I've always felt that women businesses tend to fill voids in their lives. Mm-hmm. And, you know, your path into VenueBook was really something that you were insanely frustrated with mm-hmm. and saw an opportunity. And so you began this company. So let's go back and talk about your entrepreneurial moment, although my guess is you probably had entrepreneurial moments a lot sooner on when you were a child.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. I started VenueBook because I remember very fondly, well, not fondly, I guess, that's probably why I started the company, but walking down the streets of Chicago nonprofit that I ran finance for, startup nonprofit, we wanted to do a fundraiser. And we knew we could get people there. We knew we could charge for tickets, but we had literally no idea where to do it. We didn't know where to find somebody. We didn't know like what we were looking for. And there is sort of one street in Chicago that has a lot of the bars. And really what we did is we just started walking into lounges and bars and clubs to say like, would you host this event? And that was when I had that typical, there's got to be a better way to do this type epiphany. But, you know, to your point, I had a lot of entrepreneurial nature in me already. You know, growing up, I never had that typical job that everybody else had. You know, I actually was a figure skater growing up. So what I did is when I...
You were?
I was.
I did not know that.
I know. The fun fact for you during this podcast. but unlike, you know, working in kind of your like working like as a lifeguard or those types of things that people do in the summer, I actually was a figure skating coach and I like built my own little business. I got all my own clients, all these little figure skaters, set my own schedule, got to do whatever I wanted. But it was really interesting because I felt like that kind of laid the groundwork. And both of my grandfathers were big entrepreneurs that had kind of worked their way up and really built businesses. And so I think it was just kind of in my DNA a little
so
bit.
So you were a skater. That is really interesting.
I was. I was a very competitive figure skater.
There is something about that in general in regards to like that kind of mentality, which mm-hmm. is, you know, I'm going to succeed. I mean, I am invested in someone who was a marathon runner. Mm. And her mm-hmm. answer was like, you know, I just keep running, you know? And I was like, I like that answer.
I just keep going.
You know, you just keep going. Yes. So when did you start doing that? What age were you?
I was probably about 5 years old. So I grew up in Minnesota. And, you know, everybody either plays hockey or skates. When I ended up sort of retiring from competition, I was skating 7 days a week. And sometimes during the school year, I would skate both. I would practice both before school and after school. And so wow. it was a different sport.
Were your parents like do it or were you like totally into it?
I mean, I couldn't have done it without them. You know, I actually wrote my college essay about the car trips that my mom and I would make to and from the skating rink like early in the morning and sort of like how important that was. You know, skating 7 days a week was no joke. I mean, that was dedication. I didn't have any other sports or activities that I could do.
And how long did you keep it up?
So I skated from the age of 5 until junior year competitively. My junior year of high school, I decided sort of, you know what? I was never going to be an Olympian. It's funny. Something about figure skating, everybody wants to ask you if you're going to the Olympics. But
I think that's with every sport.
Yeah,
I think you get to a point in those singular mm-hmm. sports, it's like, am I going to really mm-hmm. – you know, do this.
And, but to be able to do that, I mean, you have to give up your life, especially because figure skating, I mean, if you want to be in the Olympics, you basically have to move away from your family and train full time by roughly the age of 10 to 12.
I'm sure.
And I mean, to make that sort of life decision, and I'm frankly, you have a better chance of getting into the NHL or the NFL. I mean, if you think about it, how many teams are there? How many people there? The Olympics are every 4 years. And at max, 3 people go.
Right.
And that's so, I mean, that's a big risk to be able to take that on. You get injured and, you know,
it's over.
Your whole life is gone.
So in junior high school, you're like, I'm done with this.
Yeah. You know, I loved it and it was great, but I was never going to like the Olympics. And I sort of decided my last year of high school, I wanted to do a couple of different things. That was when I started doing a lot of coaching. And it was great. I mean, I was the youngest person on staff. I had all these little students.
Coaching probably something it taught you about management.
Completely. And, you know, it was great. I mean, I had everything from like the 3-year-old that was learning how to skate to somebody who was a lot older and a lot more disciplined. I mean, talk about learning how to work with a wide range of people. And so it was a great experience. Though it's interesting that it was kind of risky to stop competing the year before I was about ready to develop my college applications. And it was something that I considered, something that I talked to my parents about, but I sort of was like, you know what? I'm just going to do it. And like looking back, that may have been a little bit of a risk of like, why do you do this, right? You know, colleges want to see that consistency, all of that, but it was just something that I was drawn to and it didn't end up affecting me at all. I actually think in a way it gave me a much like more well-rounded experience because
you were willing to say I've had enough.
Yes, yes. But I channeled it into something important and doing other things, which is probably something, you know, when I think back to all those applications, they probably saw that was important.
Right. Certain.
Versus like when I quit competing, I didn't – it's not like I just was sitting around.
I you know, it's interesting. I was having this conversation with someone this week about what do you look for in entrepreneurs. And I think that he said, do you think it's innate or do you think it can be taught? There is a lot of people – that are really smart with a lot of ideas, but are they really entrepreneurial people? Mm. And he said, I'm looking for people that it could be a variety of different things that pinpointed times in their life that they were entrepreneurial without even realizing they're entrepreneurial. Mm-hmm. So certainly running a ice skating business is entrepreneurial.
It was very entrepreneurial. And actually, my first job out of school was really entrepreneurial, even though it was in the finance world, which may sound so unentrepreneurial. But I got this really unique job at Fidelity Investments, which it's funny. I really didn't want to move to Boston. I wanted to move to New York City. And this was the only job I got. So I moved to Boston. And I was a little disappointed. But it was a great gig because literally they basically decided that smart people would show their stripes, and they said, you know, here's your Amex card, unlimited balance, here's your computer, you cover these 25 companies, they're industrial companies, do whatever you want. It's really simple. Either you make the firm money or you save us money by not losing us money. It's actually a really easy equation. And I sat there and I thought, oh my gosh, why did they hire me? Like I didn't even know what a model was. I remember because I had to forecast these companies, I had to do all these things. And I went into my boss's office and I was like, I don't even know what a model is. Like, can you help me? I remember panicking for 2 weeks and then I just figured it out. It was like my own little mini business. I had to create a brand. I had to sell my ideas to portfolio managers. I had to build connections. And it was great. I mean, I know more about oil pumps than I would ever have expected.
That's so funny.
Got to do a lot of really cool things. But it's funny, I left that and became more of an entrepreneur because I was drawn to operating. That I liked kind of owning my own thing, but I wanted to operate.
Right.
Which is why I like
to do what I'm doing. Which you still do
today. I do. What's interesting too about your point around entrepreneurship being innate is that I've been reading a lot about grit actually lately. I don't know. I feel
Did
like
you
it's
read
the
book. Are you reading the?
I read
Angela,
a little bit of it.
Angela Duckworth.
Yes, I listened to the Freakonomics podcast on it, which is very good. If you're a podcast fan listening to this, I also recommend it.
And I hear
it.
She's amazing.
Yes. And I think what's interesting about it is I think to this idea of entrepreneurship being innate is that a lot of people have ideas. But sometimes I feel as if being an entrepreneur is just waking up every day and saying, I'm going to keep at it. Because there are so many things that are thrown in your way. And I mean, if you'd asked me a few years ago some of the stuff that I would see, I would not have believed you. But it's part of getting up and being like, I'm going to keep doing this.
Right.
I'm going to keep doing this. Because if I really believe in this.
It's a survivor mentality.
It is. It's a survivor mentality. And I think there's something innate about that. Or it's taught more from your family or this or that. And I've been reading a lot about it more because now with two kids, I was like, how do I make sure that they have that? You know, they can be smart, they can be driven, but they need to have that to be successful.
That's a very good point. Did we learn that grit because we wanted something more than where we came from? Or is it something we just always wanted? Was it something that was taught? I mean, that's a really interesting thing.
Mm-hmm.
Grit's funny.
And, you know, I'm not sure I perfectly know the answer to it.
I don't know if I do either.
And, you know, I mean, there's all this talk about the self-esteem generation and millennials. And I think you see a little bit of that, not as much in them sometimes. And they're quite talented.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes you kind of have to tell them, you know, you got to get up at 9 a.m.
Totally.
Get to work and pay your dues.
Completely.
You know?
So you went back to grad school at one point in this, didn't you?
I did. So I went back to grad school and I had this idea and I had this opinion that I was either going to go work for a startup, go be a VC, because I did like investing. I do like numbers, or go start my own company. But I had this idea and I felt, you know, now is like, why not now? Seize mm-hmm. the day, and decided to do it, you know. But I'd been given some great advice early on, which was start small but think big. So I probably
which
started,
is one of my favorite things.
And you know, it was great advice. And I will say, we probably VenueBook probably started in a little bit of a different way. You know, we had overseas developers. It was just me, completely bootstrapped. I mean,
I remember when I met you.
The way I learned about the industry actually is that I had had the problem of booking the events, but I knew that I didn't know anything about venues because I'd never operated a venue. And so what I wanted to do was build those venue connections and start to understand how they operate. And I think that was really key for VenueBook and what we built today, because we took a very different view of the industry early on.
You went an opposite way. You didn't put this out there like this is a consumer platform. Mm-hmm. You literally talked to companies like a Blackstone or a Goldman Sachs mm-hmm. that book these events all day long mm-hmm. so that to make their lives easier, what is it that they need? And I thought that was a very smart way that you went about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So anyway, so you went on and, you know, you bootstrapped mm-hmm. For so long mm-hmm. And you have persevered. I mean, you wake up every day and you continue onward.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, at the beginning, it was very hard to get anyone really excited about what you were doing.
Completely. I mean, I remember – so we obviously, as you know, took a software-first approach, and that was wildly unpopular. It was wildly unpopular. And I remember we had one competitor who was just a listing site, and they were trying to do all of the bookings and like basically do everything behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. And they raised a bunch of money, and I was trying to raise money as a software-only site. And I just remember literally it was as if they knew where I was going every day, that they would time enormous press right as I was walking into a venture capitalist office. And the venture capitalist would say, oh, well, why would I ever invest in you? This company has already won the whole market. And part of my opinion was like, well, they actually don't truly understand the market. And they went from two people to like 40 and then down to two. And so I was right, but it was a really, really, really hard time. And, you know, I mean, if I think about actually what's happened in the industry in terms of software innovation, we really have blazed the trail. A lot of the innovation that's even happened in this space, we rolled out that feature first and then people would start to copy it. You know, what's interesting is like having been wildly unpopular as a software player for a while, one of the things that surprised me is that as we had success, people copied us very quickly, which was a really good learning for me. And I think very differently as we roll out new things, how quickly the cycle is that if that's successful, that people will rip it off. I mean, it's the highest form of flattery, but it's also really important to always kind of stay ahead of the competition if you're rolling out new things very quickly.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the frustrating things about any business. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing you can do to stop it. And so now how many cities are you in?
We're in four cities. We're in mm-hmm. New York, DC, San Francisco, and Chicago.
And people on average, who's your average booker?
Our average booker is a corporate, what we like to call sort of the accidental planner. They
for sure
are charged with booking events for their company, but they don't, it's not their full-time job. They are taking the interns out. They are doing the board dinner. They are doing a recruiting event. And so they have 8 million things flying across their desk and they have a budget. It's like, you've got $5,000 for this intern event. It's in 3 weeks, plan it now. And so we speak really well to that group of bookers because we are transparent, easy to use, fast turnaround, and take that really painful process off of the phone and shrink down the time to book. And for venues, I think what's important about that is that a lot of venues recognize that the profile of the booker has changed over the last few years. And so in the past, a venue could easily walk in and say, I know that this person is a global events manager. They manage a $10 million event mm-hmm. budget. They could build that relationship. They could find them. But in this world where the profile of the average person booking events is very different, we can more cost effectively aggregate them on our platform because they might do 20 events in a year, but they want to do those at 20 different venues.
Totally. You guys are definitely making inroads, particularly the businesses that have used your product and yes. that are the ones that see, oh my God, mm-hmm. we're actually making more money and, you know, we are a better operation because of this.
Yes. On both the venue and the booker side. On the venue side, venues that really follow the different way of booking that we evangelize do very, very, very well and grow their business.
And they're willing to put all the information up there.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you an interesting stat. The reason it's so important is that, you know, in the past, typically you got on the phone, you tried to negotiate, and negotiation has been a big part of this industry for years, but we have data across hundreds of thousands of bookings that say that literally you have no probability of booking the event unless you hit somebody's budget. That doesn't mean that they won't walk out the door and spend more money, but if they have a $5,000 budget, you are not booking them at $10,000. You're going to book them at five, and they may walk out the door at $7,500, but you know, in a world, people have been afraid to be transparent as venues, but I mean, we have overwhelming data to show that it pays to be transparent. Because you're not booking the business anyway, and right. otherwise you're just wasting your time.
Yeah, you want to get the right person in the door who's willing to do the event, and it's booked and it's taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk a little bit about motherhood.
Okay.
I think that, you know, this is a conversation that I know you and I talked about before mm-hmm. you had any children,
mm-hmm.
You know, which was do not wait. And I remember you called me and said, okay, I took your advice and now I'm pregnant and what do I do? Yeah.
There's never a good time.
There's never a good time. And talk about how that's changed you as an entrepreneur
mm-hmm.
and your fear of being pregnant for the first time as an entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's first off, I like to think a venue book was my first baby. So, you know, I got used to that. But, you know, I think the hardest thing with the first child is that you really don't know what to expect. So there's just a kind of an underlying fear of the unknown is mm-hmm. the best way to put it. But I've learned very much through motherhood that it is not about working longer hours. It is about working smarter. It's something that I evangelize to the whole company. It's something that I evangelize for myself. And is that if you're, for example, if you're getting paid to make really good decisions as the CEO, it doesn't pay to work 24/7 if you can't make good decisions when you're completely exhausted all the time and you have
completely.
No headspace. And so I think what has been good about becoming a mom is that you just have a different demands on your time. It's
completely.
Really that simple. And so it was a forcing mechanism of big shifts I had to make in the way I manage, the way I grew the company, the way I even thought about managing my day-to-day time. And so I
you
believe –
you have no time for micromanaging.
You have no time. And, you know, I really do believe that you can do both. However, it's a trade-off. And I think – where people fall down is trying to be perfect in all areas of their life. I mean, my apartment is just never clean. It's fine. So I can either, you know, run a company, spend time with my kids and clean my apartment and literally never sleep, or I can just accept that there are things that have to be let go. And there was a great, I think an article in The Atlantic about finding that really successful high, very competitive, driven women, once they have children, fall into like three camps. One is they are very successful and they have just realized they have to let other things go, but they don't feel guilty about it. One decided, I want to take the stay-at-home mom path, but they're very driven in everything they do around the house. Like they're the CEO of their household. And then there was a group in between who is the most unhappy because they tried to be perfect in all areas of their life.
It's impossible.
And it just, it doesn't exist. And so when people ask me like, how do you do it? I was like, you just have to let things go.
You do.
You know what? Like, I'm not around for my kids all the time, but like when I'm there, I'm very present. And so I'd rather be really present for an hour or two or checked out for, rather than checked out for 8 hours at home, for example.
I like that. I mean, I do. I think that you have to be willing to let go. I mean, you know, I used to be crazy when the kids were young about like keeping the house clean, whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, I realized.
You are a better person than me when it comes to that.
I was crazy. And I was just like, oh, you know what? At one point, it'll all clean itself up.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of start letting it go, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I do think that I have seen more women who have had children through their entrepreneurial journey of starting mm-hmm. something and becoming a founder and then a CEO and having all these people work for them,
mm-hmm.
that when they have children, they become better CEOs.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I also think too, being a mom, we've created a great culture for where you are at whatever stage in your mm-hmm. life, and that we support people who have families that, you know, need to leave at 5. But hey, if you're a single person and you want to roll in at 10 and you like to work till 9 p.m., that's not a big deal. I think our thing is that we've set up an environment of trust where you're going to have trust if you get your work done. If you don't get your work done, you're going to hear from me, really simply. And so as part of that, we have a very, very diverse company. I mean, we are mixed race. We are mixed age. We are pretty even men, women. And I think that's because we've created, you know, we don't have that bro-tastic mm-hmm. tech culture that you think of. We have a very different culture. It is work very hard, get your stuff done, move the needle, but we're not going to micromanage you because you know what? Like, if you want to go hit your kid's soccer game at 5 p.m., you should, because I know whether you're moving the needle or not. So I'm not going to force you to sit at your desk.
I'm a big fan of this. I mean, I think that if more companies thought like this,
mm-hmm.
you would have more women that perhaps stayed in the workforce
mm-hmm.
because they're not being told, you know, that they can't be home if the kid's sick or they can't go to the soccer game, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
I think that good workers are good workers.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, end of story. And talk a little bit like how, when you were like, okay, I'm pregnant, and how am I going to tell the board? How am I going to tell the company? You know, is everyone going to be like, oh my God, you know,
mm-hmm.
this is the worst thing that ever happened? Because I do think that, you know, men can't get pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So they're never in this position.
Yes. What's interesting is, first off, I credit you completely for giving me the best advice you gave me. Because when I called you, I told you this. I said, you know, I'm not worried about myself, but I'm worried other people will be worried. And you gave me the great advice of just state it and move on. And that's what I've done in all areas of like, I'm a mom, I was pregnant, I was this. I basically am like, I don't make a big deal of it, so people don't make a big deal of
That's
it. When
right.
I told the team, I basically said with my first, I was like, I am pregnant. I am due at this point. Like, once we get closer, we'll talk about what the plans are for like when I have the baby and when I'll be back in the office. But
business
no big
as
deal.
Usual.
Business as usual. It was literally like a 5-minute quick announcement and we moved on.
Exactly.
And so, you know, I've done that with investors. I've done that with the board. I've done that with partners, and it's not a big deal.
It's not. And you're right. I mean, I've seen women who are just so obsessed about it, and they're just like, you know, I'm going to plan everything. I've got everything set mm-hmm. up, blah, blah. You know, you don't need to do that because
yes.
then you're making a mountain out of a molehill. Right?
Mm-hmm.
It'll all work itself out. Actually, Anne-Marie Slaughter talks about this, which I thought was great, was when she decided her husband stayed home, basically,
mm-hmm.
and she went back to work. And she literally left him, you know, here's what we're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
How's it going to work? Blah, blah, blah. And he's just like, I'm not going to run the household like you do.
Mm-hmm.
And she was just like, oh, my God, of course not.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's the same thing. I mean, you trust your team,
mm-hmm.
and they're going to get things done. And it's not like you didn't, you know, talk to anyone. Like, you know, you put up a wall and I'm like, don't call me for 3 months.
Yes.
But I think in the end, being a parent of two and having a company is like a great thing.
And you know what the thing is I think being an entrepreneur and having kids, you know, first off, you know, I'm all for maternity and paternity leave, but in a weird way, because work and family were always fluid much earlier on in having both of my kids, it was sort of that I just learned very quickly how to make them peacefully coexist. And I think one of the hard things actually is that with maternity leave, if you're gone for 6 months, that's very jarring to go from, especially with your first, you're in the rat race, you've got lots of adult human contact, to a baby who doesn't talk to you, who's up all night, and then you finally get into a groove and then you go back to work, but you've been totally out of the workforce. So in a weird way, I'm somewhat thankful that it had to be fluid, because in a strange way, I think it made the transition a little bit easier.
Yeah.
Because I had to realize that it was always going to be a little bit give and take, yeah, rather than getting completely out of it and then feeling jarred back into the working environment.
Yeah. So when's the last time you were on the ice?
Recently, basically this spring. You know, my oldest is only 2 years old, but we're trying to teach him how to skate.
All right.
So you know what? It's we live in New York City. It's totally impractical to think like he will skate regularly. But we used to go to – we went to Prospect Park a bunch like this winter and spring. It's a beautiful rink.
Yeah. And Chelsea Piers has one. And yes. There's one up in Central Park. And yeah.
You know what? My husband and I are from the Midwest. Like, we can't raise kids who don't know how to skate.
I totally
get it. Like, it's too much in our blood. No matter what they do with it, they're going to have to learn how to skate.
Listen, all our kids learned how to skate. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's certain things you just have to learn.
Yes.
You know, I mean, I think I said on this podcast, it's like they all had an instrument. They all had a sport.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone learned how to skate. Imperative you learn how to swim.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I mean, these are things. Shake a hand.
Yes. You know,
these are part
with
of your education.
Handshake.
With a firm handshake and looking someone in the eye.
Yes.
Very, very important skills. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think skating is a very important skill
yes,
as well.
Yes, we haven't started swimming yet. That's next on the list.
That's a good one. That's very important.
Yes.
Actually, little fun fact is you cannot graduate MIT without passing a swim course.
There you go.
I think it's kind of genius.
That's a good thing.
Yeah, it's a really good thing. Anyway, thank you so much for coming.
Well, thank you for having me.
And if you need to book a venue, go to venuebook.com.
Yes.
Thanks again to Kelsey for sharing her journey with us. And if you're planning an event, do yourself a favor and check out venuebook.com. I promise you, you will be glad you did. Thank you all for joining us this week. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and please subscribe to the podcast on SoundCloud or iTunes so you do not miss a minute of Positively Gotham Gal. Till next time.